to this edition of Pacer Sound. I'm Mark Monteith, and I'm here with a true Indiana basketball legend, George McGinnis. And here we're talking about a guy who was Mr. Basketball in 1969, led Washington High School to an undefeated season in the state championship, played a year of varsity basketball at Indiana University, earned All-America honors, and then joined the Pacers. He had the greatest single season the Pacer has ever had, certainly one of the greatest Pacers of all time. His number is up in the Raptors here at Bankers Life Fieldhouse. So, George, first of all, thank you for coming down and talking with us.
Yeah, no problem, Mark. It's a real pleasure to be here.
You know, real quick, just to get this out of the way, you know, in high school, you were every bit as great a football player as basketball player. You were first-team All-State, an All-American. You caught 22 passes as a tight end for 418 yards at Washington. You made 77 tackles on defense. Did you see yourself at that time as much a football player as basketball, or was it always about basketball for you?
Every bit as much about both. After I started playing football, I had never played football until I became a freshman at Washington High School, and had an incredible coach, an incredible human being, Bob Springer, and he instilled in me the fact that I could be an outstanding football player. And I absolutely love football as much as I did basketball. So when the letters started coming in for colleges, for opportunities to play basketball or football, I actually had more from football than I did for basketball.
Did you give any serious thought at all to pursuing football?
Yeah, I did a little bit, you know, but after we decided to, myself and Steve Downing decided to go to Indiana, and my dad had just been killed in an accident at Lilly a few months earlier. So only because IU's football program was not very good, I thought I just wanted to concentrate on basketball, but I was gonna try and play both ways.
Mm. Well, Quinn Buckner did that, and other people have done it, although to do it for 4 years is very tough, and you only stayed for two anyway.
Yeah, so. That's right. And I would have done it for three, not four. So.
Right, yeah. Right. So, yeah, because the freshmen were not eligible when you were in college. And you mentioned your father passing away. You know, that was just a few weeks after the Indiana All-Star Series with Kentucky. Right. You had the greatest game that anybody has ever had in that series, done in Louisville. I don't remember the exact numbers, but it was 50-some points and 30-some rebounds. And from what you've told me before, you kind of consider that a fateful performance, don't you, given
yeah.
what happened to your dad
yeah,
shortly after?
The best basketball game I had ever played in my life, and it was throughout the entire career that I had. And it was the last game my dad saw me play. So he finally said to me, he says, you know what, I think you're pretty good.
You convinced him, huh?
Yeah.
it took a while.
Yeah.
You played the 1 year at IU as a sophomore on the varsity, and then you became a Pacer. The decision to leave college and join the Pacers, how difficult was that and what brought that about?
It was very difficult. We had a little uprising with some of the guys on that team about the coaching job that Lou Watson did, who I adored. He recruited me and Steve, and I not only liked him as a coach, but I really liked him personally. But there were some guys who thought that we needed a change, and so they went to the president and, you know, they protested and things of that nature. So I thought, well, you know, I don't know if I want to stay here and have to deal with all of this, because I will still be dealing with the same people, the same guys. If they're not going to be happy with the next coach, then what happens? And it also gave me an opportunity to help my family. And helping my family, I think, was the major reason why I left.
Right. Your dad had passed away, so you want to support your mother.
Absolutely.
Right. And was she having to work during all this time, like when you were in college?
Yeah, she worked at different jobs. She did housekeeping and things like that. So we had a tough life. Coming here from Alabama, my mom grew up picking cotton, as my dad. And they came here for a better life. And my dad, you know, he worked two jobs from the time I've known him. So from the time I was a little boy, he worked construction during the day and he worked in a factory at night. And he wanted my mom to stay home and take care of me and my sister. So he was very honorable in that way. And after he died young, 42 years old, it left a very big void in our family. And, you know, I didn't want my family to have to suffer anymore.
Yeah. Do you remember what your contract was that first year?
Yeah, I just found the article, Mark, about a month ago, and my wife brought it to me, and it was $35,000 with a $10,000 housing bonus. No, a $5,000 housing bonus and then $10,000 for a car. And boy, I thought, man, if I could make this for 10 or 12 years, you know, I'd be set.
Well, you wound up making a lot more than that. But, you know, this is 1971, so that was a very
good
salary.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, I don't know what a middle-class salary would have been at that time, but it would have been certainly less than that.
Well, I think most guys, I knew a couple of buddies who had done really, you know, gotten with companies. They were $12,000, $13,000, $15,000. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was a good salary back then.
Yeah. Well, you joined a team, a Pacer team, that had won a championship in 1970 and had had the best regular season record in 1971 during your sophomore year at IU. Did not win the championship, but, you know, certainly could have. So you're joining a set team. How were you accepted coming in as this, what, 19-year-old kid or whatever you were at the time? What was it like joining a veteran team like that?
Well, I was very nervous about it, but you know what? It was it just showed the type of guys who were on that team and why we're still close today. They all accepted me with open arms. Little did I know, there were half of them had came to my games as a high school player and seen me play. Freddie Lewis and Roger and Mel. And so that was, you know, I didn't even know that they were. No one ever said to me they had came to the games, but then they told me they saw me throughout the state tournament. And Freddie came back and he told the guys, he said, I saw a young guy the other night. I think he could start for us today.
Well, you might probably
so,
could have.
Yeah, so it was great. They were great, all of them.
Yeah, and as that season went on, your rookie year, you became a starter later in the year.
Right.
And that year, you played Denver in the first round of the playoffs, I believe. Just to show people what the atmosphere was like then, in game four in Denver, you guys lost by 16 points. And here's what Slick Leonard says after the game. I'm sick and tired of what they're doing to our players, referring to the referees. And they can send a note to the commissioner and say if I get fined, he'd better get some better officials. And the ones who have threatened to go back to the NBA should go back. We can get high school officials that good. So, you know, that's Slick. And, you know, of course, if you did say that today, you'd be fined, suspended, and all that kind of thing. But I'm, as a player for him, when he's talking that way in the newspapers and sticking up for you guys that way, what kind of atmosphere does it create?
Well, he constantly preached the family. You know, we're all in this together. It's us against the world. You know, just certain things that he would say. Let's walk out here if we're on the road in a playoff game. Let's walk out here like we own the place. No tears, no fears, you know. And he just had a way about him that, you know, he didn't take anything from anybody and he didn't want anybody cheating him. If he felt like he was going to get cheated, he let him have it. So it, you know, made you feel good as a player that this guy had your back.
Yeah. Yeah, no question he had your back. You guys beat Denver. This is the 72 playoffs. You beat Denver in seven games. Then you beat Utah in seven games after being down 2-0, and you won game seven in Utah.
I think we won game seven in Denver, didn't we?
Yes, you did.
We won that entire championship on the road.
Most of the great Pacer moments in history have come on the road. It's just amazing.
Yeah.
People talk about home court advantage, but you know, you guys won all three championships on the road. You, like we just said, you beat Denver in game seven on the road. You beat Utah in game seven on the road. Then you play New York with Rick Barry for the ABA championship in 1972. In game six, you probably had your best game to that point, 30 points. I'm sorry, game three. This is game three. You had 30 points and 20 rebounds. The interesting thing about that team, though, as I've learned over the years, there's some inner turmoil. I mean, you had a couple guys on that team who wanted out. I mean, Rick Mount came out in the papers. that year and won it out, and Nedelicki, probably because he lost the starting spot to you. I know when the Des Moines, Iowa newspaper said, I want out of here, and yet you guys managed to win a championship. I'm just curious what it was like as a member of that team.
Once we were in the heat of the battle, you know, they forgot about that, you know, and when they did get in, I think they played hard and they helped the team. But, you know, it's understandable. You think about Rick Mount. I mean, come on. He's one of the all-time great basketball players from this state. I've got so much respect for him. When he was on this team and I came in as a rookie and I saw him come out for practice the first time, I was in awe because his sophomores in high school, myself, Steve Downing, and a kid named Jim Arnold, we drove up to Lebanon just to see that sign. Says home of Rick Mount, because he was on the cover of Sports Illustrated, and it was just it was an incredible moment for me to be able to get to know him. He was very inward. He didn't talk to a whole lot of people. So I walked up to him. I said, "Rick, I want to shoot you a horse," and he said, "Why? Shoot me a horse? You don't have a chance." I says, "Well, you never know." I said, "If you give me," and he just kind of blew me off, and I kept kind of nudging him. And finally, he did, and it was over in seconds. Yeah. But it's one of the great moments of my life, being able to play horse with him. But he was tremendous. And so I understand, Mark, how he felt. You know, he had been a star his whole life. And, you know, then he didn't get to play. He wasn't starting. So it was very difficult for him.
That was a team that almost had too much talent. Really? I mean, you're talking about, first of all, three Indiana Mr. Basketballs. Billy Keller, 1965, Rick Mount, 1966, and you from 1969. Then you have Roger Brown, future Hall of Famer. Mel Daniels, future Hall of Famer.
And MVP.
And MVP of the league, two-time MVP. Freddie Lewis, to me, one of the most underrated Pacers. Great point guard. Neto, who was a multiple all-star in the ABA. Darnell Hillman is on that team. So you're talking about a team overloaded with talent, and there were bound to be some guys who were unhappy with their playing time.
Trying to find a right fit and time for all those guys was impossible. And Slick did a good job of it. But, you know, you can't make everybody happy. The bottom line is that team ended up winning a championship, and that's what it was all about.
Absolutely. Now, you guys won that series in six games, but you did close it out in New York. And Freddie was the MVP of that series, by the way. So the following season, the 1972-73 season, Rick Mount and Neto, their trade requests were granted. They were gone. Yeah. So that probably kind of cleans up the roster a bit and puts the pieces in place. So you're starting with Roger Brown and Mel Daniels up front. Freddie Lewis is in the backcourt with either Billy Keller or Donnie Freeman, whoever was the other guard.
It was Donnie Freeman, yes.
Yeah. And you really come into your own that year because, you know, you've got a year under your belt. You're starting all the time. You had a game at Dallas where you scored 58 points. You just think if you'd hit your free throws that night.
Oh,
you were 14 and 21 from the foul line.
Think if I was a halfway decent free throw shooter, I'd probably have 1,000 more.
But you had 58 points in the game at Dallas. Now, you played Kentucky for the championship that year. It was a weird series for the championship because the home team lost four games in that series. And it was appropriate that you guys won Game 7 in Louisville to win that championship. You scored 27 points and were named the MVP of that series. I would think that has to stand out certainly as one of your highlights, too.
Yeah, great moment, great memorable moment. I just got a radio play-by-play of that game. And also the championship game with the New York Nets the previous year. So, you know, the other day I went back and listened to it. It's so fun to go back and listen to it and to hear yourself talk post-game, Slick. And, you know, he got on there, of course, and he gave us all these pansies. We come in here and we kick their butt, and it was great. But that's a very memorable game, that seventh game beating Kentucky in that series. It was a tough one.
Yeah, I think, and the rivalry was great, obviously, between the Pacers and Colonels. Just a couple hours down the road, you guys would bust down to the games. They would take busloads of fans down to the games.
Yeah, it was incredible.
One story I remember from that game seven is that Roger Brown went down on his own. He drove down in his own
and
car.
He came in late.
Yes, and he got there late.
And Slick wanted to absolute kill him. We had to literally hold him back. He wanted to just fight Roger. He was so mad. And he didn't start him for the start of that ball game and brought him in later on. And we really needed him because he came in and made some big shots for us, which Roger Brown always did.
Yes, he did.
So it was so much fun, and that night at the hotel and the ride back home the next day, it was tremendous.
Yeah, nothing better than winning a championship and getting to relive it with your teammates for a day or two while you're all still together. Yeah, you mentioned Roger scored 10 points off the bench that game and hit two big jumpers in the fourth quarter, and Darnell was big in that game because Mel got hurt. And Freddie Lewis got hurt, too, so you guys had some adversity there.
Darnell and Gus Johnson did an incredible defensive job on Artis Gilmore. Gus was one of the strongest guys I'd ever met, but he knew how to use his strength, and he handled Gilmore down low. That just frustrated the heck out of him, but his game defensively was a jewel for us.
I think you got a car, right, from Sport Magazine for being the MVP. What kind of car was it?
It was a Dodge. And, I was talking to Rick Smith, who's a car lover, and it was one of these sports cars, but he said that car would be worth today $100,000. I ended up giving it to a family member who really needed a car. But it was great. Sport Magazine, I went to New York to accept it. What's the football player played at the Texas Rose? He won MVP in the NFL that year, and he also got a car. So me and him were both up there.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you didn't drive it at all, hardly, huh?
No, I never touched it. So I ended up giving it to a family member, but I wish I would have kept it now.
Yeah, it would have been a great investment, wouldn't it? You just never know those things in advance, though. So then you guys came back. The 73-74 season and didn't win. The other guys, Mel, Roger, they're getting a little older. Things are kind of in decline a little bit. And you tried to rally in the playoffs but couldn't pull it off. So after that 73-74 season, they are sent to Memphis. They're traded. Roger Brown, Mel Daniels, and Freddie Lewis are all gone. So it's your team now.
Yeah.
Going into the 74-75 season, you are without question the centerpiece of that team. At the time, did you kind of look forward to that? I mean, I know you were close to those guys, but were you excited by the opportunity to have everything kind of built around you?
Well, I kind of liked that, but I also worried about the fact that, we had went to the championship every year for three straight years. I got spoiled. And now we're losing our Warriors. Mel, Freddie, Roger, they had gotten older, and so it was kind of like we retooled. I remember Lenny Elmore being our center, and
Billy Knight's a rookie.
Billy Knight's a rookie, and we had some other guys who were really good players, but had never played in the league. So I don't think the prediction was for us to be a real good team. But we gelled and we got hot at the right time.
Yeah, you guys got off to a slow start that year, as you should have, given all the, kind of like this year's Pacer team. Whenever you have a lot of new guys, it's going to take a while for things to come together. Billy Keller was still on that team. You had Kevin Joyce, different guys. But, as I said in our intro, you had the best season a Pacer has ever had. You averaged 29.8 points, around 15 rebounds. You led the team in assists and steals, and no doubt turnovers as well. You did everything.
I had the ball a lot.
The offense ran through you, didn't it?
Yeah,
it must have been fun. You actually had your best season shooting that year. You hit 35% of your three-pointers. So everything came together for you. And, this is a team that had a couple of five-game losing streaks early on, but it all came together. You beat San Antonio in the first round of that playoff series in six games. That was one of the most emotional playoff series in the franchise history. They called it the Hang'em High Series. And, there was a game in San Antonio where Slick went down and grabbed the timekeeper by his lapels and lifted him out of his chair because he didn't.
He really pull him over the scores table, tried to anyway.
Because he
started the clock late on an out-of-bounds play, boy, and Slick just didn't like it. But it was It was memorable. That game was memorable.
Yes. And, you know, Slick, in his Hall of Fame speech, told a story from that series about you, about running over George Karl. Yeah. Can you tell us that one?
Well, yeah. George Karl was one of the toughest kids I'd ever played against. He, you know, he would get in front of anybody. He'd take a charge and foul. You know, when you looked at him, he had nothing but scrapes and scars all over his knees. And he came from North Carolina, so usually most of those North Carolina guys were tough, but he had an inner toughness that was incredible. But he had a tendency just to kind of run in front of you. And he did this a couple of times to me, and he flopped, you know, which really made me mad. And I went to the ref. I said, hey, he's flopping. I said, now, you know, that's not a foul. You know, and he says, well, you know, George, you ran over him. Well, the next time we were on the court, I says, okay, we get the ball off of a rebound and get out on a quick, fast break, and I take off around the wing, and there's George Karl, and they throw me the ball, and all I had to do was literally give it back to the other player for a lay-in, but I wanted to make a point. And I went into him, and I took him into about the third row of the seats behind one of their buckets, and I threw the ball to the referee, and I said, now, that's a foul.
You made your point.
Yeah.
You ever talk to George Karl about that in later years?
I have before, but I don't talk to him too much now, but, you know, I love him. I think he was a good guy, good sport. He's talked about that quite a bit.
Yeah, yeah, he's good talking about that kind of stuff. Yeah. He was a good competitor, and he understood, you know, how things were done. Mm-hmm. Then you beat Denver in the second round. Now we're talking about Dancing Harry being here. Yeah, and then Denver, get this, the Pacers bring in Dancing Harry, who had worked some NBA games, was nationally known, and he comes in, he's putting on a cape and putting hexes on the other team during their huddles.
He was a big hit.
He was hugely popular for a short amount of time. So Denver responds by bringing out a witch called a Robata, and she would stand at your end of the court during pregame warm-ups and just stare at you.
And stare you down, and yeah, she watched the entire warm-up. It was almost intimidating, you know. She had this makeup on, and she had this black hood, and she never took her eyes off again. She stared at me.
Yes, at you in particular.
Yeah, it wasn't the other players. And so it almost got a little weird for me. I said, I hope she leaves. But it went on the entire warm-up, and finally the game started, and I was over it. But it did kind of bother me a little bit.
Some witches staring at you. Oh, it's just amazing. You know, obviously, that kind of thing would not happen today. But you guys won that series in seven games on the road again. So what was it, again, about Slick that would give you guys the confidence to win all these game sevens on the road?
Oh, I think it was Slick. He was innovative. He'd taken, changed the whole offense. For two of those wins, it was Kentucky and it was Denver that we played in seventh games, and he changed the entire offense. He flip-flopped in that particular game, myself and Billy Knight. Denver had been pressing full court the entire series and giving our guards some trouble. You know, we're having some trouble turning the ball over or not getting the ball over the half-court line in 10 seconds. So me and Billy Knight would bring the ball up and start the offense from where we had the ball. So it was things like that. And, you know, calling a big play. I remember we were in a situation in the fourth quarter, and he called the play for me. It was going down the stretch. And the play broke down, and Billy Keller ends up wide open. I hit him out in the corner, and he hits that three-pointer, never touches the rim. And it was a big shot. And I can remember going in the locker room, and we're celebrating. Slick's going, where's the beer? Where's the beer? And so we get in there, and the reporter's asking him. He says, boy, Leonard, that was a big play that you ran for Billy Keller. You know, and it was just one of these plays that just happened. It was nothing that we ran. And I'll never forget Slick said to the reporter, he says, well, boy, sometimes if you're going to be in this league, you got to make big decisions.
It was basically a broken play.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, wasn't that the Boom Baby game?
Yeah.
That was when Slick
first boom. baby.
Yeah, Slick yelled, boom, baby.
It was the first time we ever heard Billy hit that shot, and he come out of the seat, and he jumped up with both hands and said, boom, baby.
And that, so, the rest is history regarding that. Right. And we should add that Denver at that time was coached by Larry Brown, the Hall of Fame coach. So, you know, you're talking about some serious chess games going on between coaches. So then, you know, this time the Pacers, rather than the odds-on favorite, are the Cinderella team of the ABA, and you play Kentucky. And you lost that series in the finals in five games. They had a great team, and you were injured. I remember I've seen game five of that series when they won it, and you're kind of limping around out there.
Yeah, I got I had an ankle problem. I think I turned my ankle in, I think, the second or third game, but I played through it. But they were clearly the better team. They just had so much talent. And they had been to, I think, three finals or two or three finals and never won anything. So they were due.
Yeah.
And they were coached by Hubie Brown, who did a terrific job with them.
Yeah, they were building to that moment for like 8 years, and they had Artis Gilmore and Louis Dampier, and I think Maurice Lucas was on that team.
No, he wasn't on that team. He was with St. Louis. They had one of the Joneses.
Wilbert Jones,
yes.
Yeah. So obviously, you know, like you say, they were due. And it was a great accomplishment for the Pacers, you know, to get to that point. But at that point, you know, look, the Pacers are really struggling financially. You were the co-MVP of the league that year with Julius Erving. I think a lot of people felt like you actually deserved it, but Julius had kind of the bigger name. He was playing in New York.
Yeah.
He was the dunker, all that kind of thing. At the time, were you at all bothered by sharing the MVP honor with him? Or?
You know, I never really thought about it like that. I mean, you know, I wasn't consumed with so much individual awards because we were all just so used to winning. It was so much fun just to win as a team. And the fact that we didn't win, but we so overachieved, that team, it was amazing. It was kind of the same atmosphere we had with the older guys who had left, that we came together and we were out there for one cause. And it was great. But no, I didn't worry about that. I mean, I thought I had the best season of any player, but I understood the market and I understood you know, Julius brought light to that award, you know, by me being able to share it with him.
What did you get for winning that award? Anything in particular? Did you get another car? Or?
No, we got a trophy. You know, Sport Magazine had kind of given cars away, especially to the ABA. So I just got a little trophy for that.
I'm curious, at your house, do you display any of your hardware or memorabilia from your career, whether it's high school, ABA?
No, I don't display anything at my house. I got a few things in my office. I got that MVP trophy. Got a few things from high school, a few things from IU, but not much in my house.
Do you still have the net from your state championship?
Yeah,
do you have a piece of that net?
And I've got almost half a net from my high school game, and that's one of my most prized possessions.
Absolutely. Okay. So at this point, the Pacers simply cannot afford you. I mean, the market for your services is such that the Pacers are priced out of the market because of just the lack of capital the owners had. And you signed with Philadelphia, probably tripled your salary or whatever. I don't know. Yeah. And what's interesting looking back is that there seemed to be no hard feelings even from the fan base because they understood. You know, nobody can deny a player the opportunity to increase his salary by that much. You came back for an exhibition game the following season as a Sixer, which had to be painful for the Pacer fans to see. But even then, if I remember right, you got a standing ovation,
which was unusual. Usually when a player leaves a team like I did, you know, there's some animosity. But, you know, I think everyone understood the front office, the players, and even the fans, which made me feel really, really good when I came back here.
And you were an all-star for a couple of years in Philadelphia. You wind up played in Denver for a while for Larry Brown, and then you are traded back here.
Yeah.
Slick brings you back in a trade for Alex English, and you finish your career here.
Right.
You know, guys in your era did not play as long as today. I think you were 32 when you had to retire.
Yeah. And 11 years was 11, 12 years was about it. For guys in my era, guys didn't work out. It wasn't a full-time 12-month-a-year gig like, you know, keeping yourself in shape. You went to camp to get in shape. When I first came with the Pacers, there were five guys who had summer jobs, you know, working with television or working in a factory. It was a different time.
Yeah. What did you do in your summers mostly?
I just rode horses. I had fun. But, you know, I just got away from the game.
As you look back, of course, nobody then was working out like they do today. But do you kind of think, man, if I could have done that, if I could have worked out the way these guys work out or whatever.
Extended our career for sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No question. But none of these, none of the things that they have, the technology that's been brought to the game and to working out, none of that was available to us.
Yeah. Yeah, it's such a shame. But still, hey, you played a long time. You had a great career. You've got a couple championships to your name.
Yes.
So, you know, that makes it all worthwhile, certainly. And not to mention the high school and collegiate accomplishments. The thing about, you know, the Pacers in your era that everybody talks about, that you guys reflect on, is just the camaraderie you had with your teammates.
Yeah.
You mentioned riding horses. Like, you guys would ride horses together. I guess you would ride motorcycles together.
Mel got everybody together because he loved horses. And he says, we all got to get a horse. It's so much fun. You know, I had never ridden a horse before. And we did it, and we loved it. Slick road. It was great. And then we had motorcycles, but we did everything together. Our summers were spent together. The stat crew would throw parties once a month where we'd go over one of their homes and just have a cookout. So it was more of a family atmosphere. You know, everybody rooting for everybody. So it's a lot different than it is today.
Yeah, it was. It was just almost like a family business in a sense that where everybody was really connected, including, as you said, the stat crew and front office people and players, coaches, everybody were together. Endorsement opportunities were not then what they are now for athletes. Did you have anything going as a Pacer?
I mean, Billy probably got most of the just local stuff. I didn't have any national endorsements. But Gatorade, we were the first two basketball players to endorse Gatorade, myself and Billy Keller. It was brought to Indianapolis by
The company? Stokely Van Camp.
Stokely Van Camp, yeah. And he bought that, and now you look to see what it turned into today. And the advertisement we did was pretty neat, Mark. It was a Gatorade bottle, a quart bottle, and it imposed me and Billy kind of leaning back on either side of the bottle. And that was, we did big billboards with that. And then we made quite a few appearances for him. And that was just a little bitty company back then.
Yeah, and you probably got really just a little bit of money too, right?
Yeah, a little bit of money. And then we had deals with our sponsors. Gas was 70 cents a gallon. And we had deals with the Marathon and people like that. So it was good.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was just an entirely different world. It's funny to look back at some of the game programs, what people were endorsing, you know, dry cleaners, the Bonanza restaurants where you guys would go. Billy had some, not only the Dairy Association, but down lakefront homes or whatever.
Yeah, and it was down at Raccoon Lake.
Raccoon Lake, exactly.
Yeah.
And
we did a promotion for a motor home.
Okay.
Me and Billy got a motor home to share for
nice.
So that was pretty nice.
You had to share it though, huh?
Yeah. We had a good time with it.
Let's see what you know. What was it like? I mean, you're in your hometown. You grew up in Indianapolis. Mm-hmm. You played high school ball in Indianapolis. You went to Indiana University. And then you're a professional basketball player, you know, leading teams to championships. I mean, that must have been just an incredible experience to be in your hometown where you're that popular and that good. I mean, I would think every day was just like a dream.
Yeah, well, and just think about how many players have had that opportunity to play your high school, college, and pro career right here in the place that you were raised. It was incredible because, you know, not only that we have a rich basketball history. But, you know, your family was there to support you, your friends. Now, in today's game, that's a deterrent.
Yes.
You know, it's a real deterrent, but back then, it was a great support system for me.
I guess you probably did not have the issues that today's players might have with all your high school buddies. George, can you give me tickets? You know, this kind of thing.
And never like that. I mean, if there might have been one or two guys, but, you know, they could afford a ticket. You know, jobs were plentiful, and
tickets were cheap.
Tickets were very cheap. Slick said, you know, the old saying, Slick said you could get a front row seat at the Coliseum for $3 and a gallon of beer, you know. Very affordable, a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, hey, we could go on forever telling these stories, but I'd like to thank everybody for listening to this podcast. George, thank you for sharing your story.
Yeah.
And hopefully we can do it again sometime. That's Pacer Sound. I'm Mark Monteith. Thanks for listening.